This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Ten years ago, Radio EcoShock heard from many peak oil experts predicting oil would run out within a few years and the price would skyrocket beyond our ability to afford it. That didn't happen yet in North America for two reasons. One, consumer demand in many Western countries dropped as vehicles and other fossil fuel burners responded with more efficient products, and people cut back on non-essential travel. Two, hydraulic fracturing of rock, fracking, produced a small tidal wave of natural gas, which has replaced oil in some functions, like heating and electric generating plants. This all happened despite a falling price of oil and overproduction for domestic and market reasons by major oil-producing countries. Now the energy demon has returned for the United Kingdom. A new study published by the Edinburgh Geological Society finds the UK's oil and gas reserves, quote, will run out within a decade. And the lead author is Professor Roy Thompson from the University of Edinburgh School of Geosciences. Roy Thompson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Your report asks, can fracking for gas and oil power the Scottish economy? Does your research allow you to talk about the oil and gas situation for all of the UK, including Britain, for example?
Yes, since doing the work for the Edinburgh Geological Society, I've extended it by looking at the whole of the UK, looked at different areas in the north and the Midlands of England, and also looked into the amount of gas and oil that's likely to be remaining on the continental shelf surrounding the whole of Britain.
Well, just to orient us for those who are not in the UK, how self-sufficient in energy was the UK during its North Sea oil and gas heyday?
Well, Britain has been very well endowed with energy resources for hundreds of years. So originally coal powered the British Empire for, yes, many hundreds of years. It peaked, production in coal peaked around about the time of the First World War, and then it's gradually declined until it essentially all came to an end in the era of Maggie Thatcher. The other energy resource we've had, particularly in Scotland, is we had the world's very first petrochemical industry, and that was based on oil shales, and that started in the 1850s. Again, the resource was exploited, peak production in the First World War, and that came to an end in 1964. And then, as you say, Britain since the 70s has been really lucky in that we've had some giant oil fields found on the continental shelf, and they have been providing the whole of our energy resource, even giving us resources we could export. And that went on through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, peaked in 1999. And then since then, both oil and gas have been gradually declining. And what I've been finding is that our production rates are much higher than the rates at which we're now finding oil and gas. And so it's fairly simple to me to demonstrate they'll only last for maybe a decade or so.
How can such large oil fields as discovered in the North Sea run out?
Well, the world's resources are limited. And in the same way that our coal has run out and that our oil shales have run out, although they are absolutely giant fields, developed countries just need vast amounts of energy. And so we use it at this incredible rate nowadays that resources that would have seemed large in the 1970s are at their end of their life.
You know, in American states like Colorado, let's talk about fracking. They allow fracking rigs to operate right next door to schools or in the middle of residential suburbs. The pollution is huge, but hey, money and energy appear to trump all. That seems unlikely in the UK, doesn't it?
Well, yes, for two reasons, I think. People are perhaps more worried about the environment here. But also what I've found is that the geology in the UK doesn't match with those of US shale gas areas. And this isn't really the story that has been given to people in the United Kingdom and in Scotland. The story they've been given is that there are huge reserves of gas in the ground, but I don't see the geological match at all. And the reason I've got involved in this recently is that here in Scotland, the Scottish Government has a moratorium on the fracking at the moment, and in the next few weeks, it's going to have to take a decision as to whether it wants the moratorium to continue or not. The other thing in Scotland is we have the idea that we'd like to break away from the United Kingdom and have independence, and the Scottish National Party told the public at the time of the last independence referendum that Scotland was set for a new oil bonanza heralding a new golden age, and the Prime Minister Alex Salmond said there can be little doubt that Scotland is moving into a second oil boom. So again, I've looked at that independently, and my conclusion is that actually a second oil boom simply won't be coming.
Well, I have to make a disclaimer here. I come from a long line of Scots with family in Aberdeen.
Well, I come from a long line of Scots as well.
All right. You know, the other factor, there's so many factors here, but in the United States, there are continual revelations of the financial unsustainability of fracking. Wells are so short-lived, you need to keep drilling tens of thousands of them. A vast tower of debt is building up through promotion in Wall Street or in the UK, in the city. What's the financial picture for the fracking industry in Scotland?
So the Scottish Government is about to come to this decision. It commissioned six separate reports on fracking in Scotland, the geology, the likelihood of earthquakes, the finances. And the finances report came to the conclusion, which I just find incredible, is that the whole of the Midland Valley of Scotland, an area of about 100 by 100 miles, can be fracked from 20 pads. And my calculations are that we would need thousands of wells in order to generate a decent, viable shale gas industry. So that seems to me to be a complete mismatch between what the public understands here and the experiences that you've been talking about as to how wells simply have to keep on being drilled in order to keep the production going, because fracking is completely different from conventional oil and gas. Well, the North Sea has lasted 45 years or so, but as you say, typical shale wells in many regions are exhausted after 5 or so years.
Well, the other thing I think people may not realize there that we've seen in the United States and Canada is once they drill these wells, at first the production is very poor. So for the first week or two, they just leave them open with all kinds of exhaust gases and the toxic chemicals that they've tossed down in there. It's a very polluting industry. You have trucks running down the roads 24/7. There's just so much to it that people may not realize until they're your neighbors and you wish they weren't.
That's right. And so here, gas is looked on with great favour because it's felt to be a much cleaner source than coal in terms of its global warming potential. But as you've just mentioned, that calculation is really just done on all the gas that's recovered and sold commercially. It doesn't take into account all the leakage and the venting that goes on when the wells are being completed, and it often doesn't take into account transportation. For example, if the gas has to be compressed into a liquid to transport it in tankers.
Oh, that's another whole operation. We were sold that on two consecutive elections here in British Columbia that we would have LNG plants, the liquid natural gas plants, built in our north. They would create all kinds of jobs. The Malaysian government was going to pay for all this, billions and billions of dollars. It never happened, and it's not going to happen.
Yes, so, I mean, this is my vision for the UK, is that within little more than a decade, the oil and the gas will be essentially gone. Fracking won't work because the geology doesn't allow it to. And so instead, we're going to have to import all of our gas. And so we are going to have to face these problems that you are seeing, but we're not really preparing well for it because people just haven't actually grasped that the oil, offshore oil and gas industry is coming to an end. So my view is that this is the time for the UK government to make a bold transition to renewables, because otherwise the UK's economy will soon almost have to be powered completely by imported oil and gas.
Well, and there's many sides to that coin, and one of them is, who are you getting that oil and gas from? We look at how Germany is kind of over the barrel, if you want to say, from their gas imports from Russia. They're scrambling to find some way to be not so dependent on Russia for heat in the winter. We don't want the UK to be in that position.
Well, we will be, because Russia is one source. Another source is Algeria. Another source is Qatar. The one area that is likely to continue to have gas here is Norway. They happen to have, although their fields are adjacent to ours in the North Sea, their geology is just a little bit different, so they have bigger fields which last for longer, and so they will maybe go on for another couple of decades or so. But of course, as you say, Germany is keen to get oil from and gas from other places than Russia. So they too will be wanting Norwegian supplies.
I know that the government in London is promoting the construction of new nuclear power plants. Are there commercial reactors in Scotland? And will Scots choose nuclear as the answer to these problems?
Well, yes, there are still nuclear power plants running in Scotland, but there aren't any planned to be built at the moment. Much, much more likely is that Scotland will go down a renewables route. The price of energy from offshore wind farms has reduced remarkably in the last year, and Scotland is quite a windy place. We actually have the best wind potential in the whole of Europe, particularly in the offshore areas. These offshore areas are rather deep water, but it's becoming more and more possible to use them for wind farms.
What is the Helm Review and where does that fit into this picture?
Yes, yeah, so Dieter is an economist and he's been asked by the British government to prepare a report on the future of power in Britain. Dieter's got some excellent textbooks out that he's written in the last couple of years, and so one can make an educated guess that he will follow the same line in his report, which is due next month in October, as he's been promoting in his textbooks. So he is really keen on the idea of fracking and using gas and electrifying everything. And the electricity will come from burning gas. And so it's, to me, it's very worrying that the UK government is getting advice saying that gas is the future, and yet my research suggests that actually the amount of homegrown gas that we can get from either continuing to exploit offshore reserves or from fracking is going to be really minimal. My view on fracking is that it might work in a few places in the English Midlands, near the coast in Lancashire and Yorkshire, but that it will never be on the scale that it has been in Canada and the US, and it might, there might be a few hundred wells or a few thousand wells, and it'll more resemble a cottage industry than an industry that can deliver energy to the whole of Great Britain.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Professor Roy Thompson from the University of Edinburgh. He says oil and gas production is doomed by decline there. Will the UK running out of energy happen rather suddenly at a certain point of time, or is it just going to creep in year by year?
Well, no, it's the production from offshore is plummeting. And so, of course, there will be a sort of the production will tail off a little bit, but basically it's going to be gone within 10 years or so. And it's the same for Scotland, that we'll go on continuing using motor cars, heating our homes by gas, and so we will simply have to import it. And then, well, you've got to pay for it. And you have to, and we have Brexit as well to worry about as to what our balance of payments will look like. I can see us going back to the time of the 70s when the coal was starting to run out before oil came. Britain had huge balance of payment problems in the 70s with the IMF being called in, with miners' strikes and so on. And I think people have just got used to the bonanza of North Sea oil and gas, and they simply are not wondering how they can cope for the situation when we have to import so much.
Well, it's like getting an inheritance, and your banker says, you know, it's starting to run out, and you keep on living the way you've been.
That's right, but we do have the possibility of changing now, looking for somebody else to give us an inheritance. And to me, that is the renewables industry. By combining particularly offshore wind with solar, by getting better storage systems, we've got experts here in Edinburgh on tidal energy. We've got experts here on carbon capture and storage. So really, Scotland has a bright future, but you have to plan for it because all these things take a long time to come in because they have to be such large plants and investments.
I do recall when staying in London at some of the cheaper hotels I could barely afford, I noticed there wasn't much insulation. There were many single-pane windows. There were some tragically cold bathrooms. Has that changed, and has it changed enough?
Well, now that's a good point you raise, and this brings us back to Dieter Helm's review and Dieter Helm's textbooks. And Dieter's view is that we don't need to insulate. We don't need to reduce the amount of energy we use. He's an economist, so he likes to see the demand increase because he thinks that will help people invest in new industries that are producing electricity cheaply. So that, it is thought, is absolutely not going to be in the government's plans. There won't be public schemes for helping with insulation, helping with energy efficiencies.
Well, we did have that program in Canada for a long time. The national government granted homeowners part of the cost of adding insulation to their homes or the purchase of energy-efficient furnace replacements, and it worked. Our energy consumption went down.
Yes.
Yeah.
That seems like a very sensible way forward. I mean, I think we're going to continue to burn oil and gas, although we'll be bringing it in from abroad. And so we will be continuing to contribute to global warming. We are still signed up to Paris, so we have to sort of try to square this energy trilemma, if you like, of that you need to provide energy cheaply, you need to provide security of supply, but also you need to try to do it without causing climate change. And somehow you have to produce a balance somewhere in the middle between all of those three. I mean, my view is that there's an excellent economic way of trying to do that by using market economics, but to nudge the market economics slightly, and to do that through the use of a carbon rebate. So this is the policy that's widely advocated by Jim Hansen. And, I mean, my understanding is that this is essentially the scheme that British Columbia uses to try to help reduce its carbon emissions. the idea that is that there is, yes, a carbon tax, but all of that tax comes back directly to citizens, possibly in terms of tax rebates. And then it's just that it's the magic hand of Adam Smith, who was a Scot. And so his invisible hand just works by itself then as a force that helps the demand and supply of goods in a free market reach equilibrium. And so this seems to me to be a very good system for trying to tackle this problem of where you should reside in this trilemma of providing energy cheaply, but without too big an impact on climate change.
Well, I could talk on at length about the carbon tax here in British Columbia. I was almost ignorant about it. It's almost invisible here. You don't realize there's other taxes you're paying at the gas pump, and this is a small one. And it turns out I do get $50 or $100 every year back in my tax rebate from that. And so I think what has to happen is the carbon tax itself has to be raised more. We almost had a leftist party, if you can believe it, try and cancel that carbon tax as a popular item, and they were defeated. So now they're back in power in a coalition with the Greens. It's a very mixed up scene, but I hope we can hold on to it and keep it going, because we are one of the few jurisdictions, as you mentioned in an email, that is actually doing it.
That's right. And so the idea is that you start off with a low tax so it doesn't create an immediate economic shock, and you just gradually increase it and increase it. And of course, you need other countries to also be doing something similar. They might not necessarily be using the carbon free rebate. They might be using other systems by putting a cap on. Eventually, it will have the effect of encouraging renewables rather than burning oil and gas. And then at that stage, the tax can be reduced. And as you say, it's not something that you might notice is happening, but this is one of the great things of it, that it's just invisibly, just through people's normal behavior of deciding what to do, that you might notice your heating bills are higher than you would have expected because of the carbon tax, so you turn the thermostat down. You might notice that gas prices are a bit higher, so you decide to walk to work that day. It's just there in the part and parcel of the way people operate.
Well, in this opportunity for renewables, you also mentioned the climate problem. We just had a top scientist tell our listeners that we are creating a climate catastrophe. So maybe it's a good thing if the people in the United Kingdom realize, if they do, that their energy supplies are limited and go with renewables faster than other countries. What do you think?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I've also worked on trying to figure out how big climate change impacts will be. And I find that it is a real problem. Climate change, it's happening now. Humans have caused global warming by the burning of fossil fuels. And I find if we just follow business's usual policies, that it'll lead to huge climate change. I'm expecting that if we don't do anything, if we don't switch to renewables, that by the end of the century, carbon dioxide will have caused temperatures to be 8 degrees above pre-industrial over the land. Really, people haven't grasped that message yet. They're hoping, well, maybe we'll be able to cope if the temperature's 1.5 or 2 degrees above pre-industrial. But really, the world hasn't woken up to how much it needs to do to actually keep temperatures down to a reasonable level.
Well, and we just had major storms on this side of the pond, including almost wiping out a couple of British protectorates in the Caribbean. Islands just flattened, one island not run by Britain, but an island totally evacuated. We don't know when or if people will be able to go back and live there. Very serious storms that are changing the geography of the Caribbean, and certainly cost over $100 billion in Texas, the Hurricane Harvey there. So we're seeing some sort of extra juice going into these storms. I think it's climate change, but there's more science to be done to absolutely nail that down.
That's right. So I used to lecture on hurricanes, And my view is actually that it isn't straightforward. We don't really know how the climate system will play out in terms of hurricanes, whether they'll be stronger, whether there'll be more of them, whether they'll follow different tracks. But one little bit of physics we do know about is the so-called Clausius-Clapeyron equation, which tells us how much extra water vapor we get in the atmosphere for every 1 degree rise in temperature. And the more water vapor there is, the more damage the hurricanes will do. But it's not all that great. So at the moment, temperatures have maybe risen about a degree since pre-industrial, and that will only have put some 5% extra water into the atmosphere. So my feeling is that, yes, there is a contribution from global warming, but it's only about 5% of the total rainfall or the wind speed that you have.
Well, 5% is quite a bit when you're talking about these volumes.
If you're close to a limit and sea level is coming up.
Well, if you've got water up to your nose and you get an extra 5%, you're under, mate. Look, getting back to your own home country as we wrap up here, does someone have a program or a plan of how Scotland can transition to clean, renewable energy?
I haven't seen a good plan because I think the Scottish Government is still under the impression that they will be able to go independent and that there will be oil and gas out there, or that they will get gas from fracking. So I think we're in a really difficult position here, that the ruling party sadly haven't got the message that the Earth's resources don't last forever. We need to use what we have wisely and efficiently. And that message that resources don't last forever hasn't yet sunk in.
After a few decades as rich producers, the UK is running out of oil and gas, according to a new report from our guest, Professor Roy Thompson, from the University of Edinburgh School of Geosciences. You can find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Roy, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In the last 2 years, Earth has experienced massive hurricanes and cyclones, not just in North America, where you may have heard about it, but in the Asian Pacific region as well. Could that be related to deforestation? Do forests moderate extreme weather? We're going to explore some science and development and new ways to view the role of living things in both climate and weather. Dr. Douglas Scheel from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences is our guest. He's a longstanding researcher and administrator in the field of forest ecology and conservation. Scheel has led projects for CIFOR, the Center for International Forestry Research, in places like East Africa and Indonesia. He's co-author of the book Tropical Rainforest Ecology, Diversity and Conservation, published by Oxford University Press. From Norway, Douglas, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
You were just in Borneo. Why?
Well, I've had some long-term research there, so it's always fun to go back and meet the people I've been working with a long time. It's kind of partly personal interest, I guess, just to see how those landscapes are developing over time. It's quite a wonderful place.
And are you finding more deforestation or less in Borneo?
Deforestation is certainly happening at quite a pace. And I guess some people are benefiting and some people are not. So I guess that was a lot of my interest in this recent trip. But overall, the livelihoods are improving, but the environmental quality is declining.
And I think that's true around the world. Now, the story of forests and hurricanes arises partly from some of your earlier work and also others about the relationships between forest cover, precipitation, and the atmosphere. Could you tell us what is the theory of the biotic pump?
Right. Well, to me, this was something that I came across. What you mentioned earlier, that I wrote a book on rainforests with colleagues. And I guess when you're writing a book, you read very widely to see what different people have been saying about the role of forests and the importance of forests, because you're trying to represent all these different ideas and theories. And I came across one really remarkable theory which explained how forests attract rain. And I realized even at the time that that wasn't the standard view. But reading the article, it was quite technical and quite difficult. And I guess I started talking to colleagues if they understood it and if they believed in it, because if it was true, it was a really quite remarkable and really important result. So I wanted to know, you know, is this true or isn't it? And I guess now I've got caught up in that whole discussion. And as I've looked harder and harder at this question, which was originally, you know, is it true or not? I've realized that we don't really know if it's true or not, but I've become increasingly convinced over time that it definitely has, it makes a major contribution to understanding many phenomena that we otherwise previously didn't understand. So I see the evidence that I've gathered over time as definitely supporting this new theory, saying that forests are actually active in generating low pressure areas. And that low pressure is actually what draws in winds from the ocean and draws in, therefore, moisture that allows forests to, I guess, water themselves is probably the simplest way of putting it. So, for example, if we look in the interior of the Amazon, we may be a couple of thousand kilometers from the ocean, but we still have a higher rainfall there in the middle of the Amazon forest than we do right on the coast. So the actual rainfall, instead of declining as you go further inland, which you would expect, generally you would expect that as you go inland, you know, some rain falls and some of that moisture runs away in rivers. And some re-evaporates into the atmosphere and can be, you know, can go further again inland. Some of it will fall, some of it will go away in rivers, and some of it will re-evaporate. And this is the kind of cycle we generally expect. So we would expect that the rainfall will decline. But in fact, in places like the Amazon, in the Congo Basin, over Siberia, instead of seeing this fall, we actually see that the rainfall is maintained way into the continental interiors. So to try and explain that phenomenon, it was actually quite useful to see that forests potentially have a mechanism where they can actually generate these low pressure areas that allow these moist winds to be brought right into the interiors. Now, I don't know if you really want me to go into the physics to explain what the biotic pump is, but I should say that this is down to two physicists whose work is basically on the physical expressions. And they had actually published this in physics journals. And I guess I've been working with them more recently to try and explore the sort of the wider implications of this idea for forests, for landscapes, for other global phenomenon, I guess. But I guess the key point is that forests have this potential to generate low pressure, and that previously hadn't been fully recognized.
Well, can you give us just an inkling of how forests could create low pressure? We can't do all the physics because it's beyond me and probably beyond some of our listeners, but, you know, just in general, how is that possible?
Well, I guess it comes down to a simple kind of concept. I'll see if this is enough for you. But the idea would be that condensation occurs in the atmosphere whenever water vapor turns from gas, the vapor, to liquid, that's or solids, to drops, or to ice. So when we actually have this water turning from the gas to the liquid or the solid, we actually have a process of a reduction in the volume of gas there, or the reduction in the number of molecules in the atmosphere. And in the past, people have generally neglected this because when that happens, there's energy released from that water vapor. And people have been preoccupied with that energy because it creates a higher temperature. And they assume that happens locally. But in fact, we don't actually have evidence that that energy that's released when water condenses is actually contained in that local volume. It could just be radiated away into space, for example. So they've neglected this actual difference in the number of particles, the reduction in gas molecules that happens when water vapor basically disappears from vapor as it becomes liquid or solid. But if you actually look at what happens physically when that happens, there's a change in the mass of the gas, there's a change in the distribution of pressures in the atmospheric column, so how the atmosphere sort of distributes its mass and pressures as you rise in that in a column over the Earth's surface. And if you actually look at that and you look at what happens in a moist column of gas versus in a dry column of gas, you see that inherently there will actually be an energetic process between the columns which actually allows and drives air to circulate. So the water vapor itself becomes a source of energy that can actually accelerate air. And accelerating air is what you need to generate winds. And forests are a very, very efficient source of water vapor. If you actually look over an area of rainforest, compare it with, for example, an equivalent area of ocean, the forest is actually more efficient at evaporating water. So you actually generate water vapor at a greater rate over forest than over any other land surface. And it's because of that ability that then you also get condensation occurring more rapidly or sooner, more frequently over forest than over any other land cover. And because condensation happens more frequently, it also generates low pressure more frequently. And because of that happens, on average, you get wind actually being brought into those forests. Mm-hmm. It's a positive feedback because, of course, when those winds come in, they're also carrying their own moisture. And when that winds, they all rise eventually because they can't all collide and accumulate. They have to rise. And when they rise, that generates rainfall. And that's a feedback process. It's bringing in moisture from outside the system.
It's such an exciting idea that trees can create the environment that they need to get the moisture that they need. And I wonder if that shares some heritage with Lovelock's Gaia theory of biological regulation of physical processes and the atmosphere.
I guess it has some similar sounding ideas to it, but I guess we would be quite clear that it is its own theory. And I guess each theory has to be evaluated on the basis of the predictions it makes of the data you can gather to show whether it actually fits the predictions or not. So I guess I'm more comfortable to look at it as an independent theory in its own right. I mean, it will stand or fall as a theory based on the predictions we can make and the data we can actually bring to test those predictions.
And now looking into this, I did look into the work of the two Russian scientists who you've worked with, the Viktor Gorshkov and Anastasia Makareva, and both are from the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute. And I'm wondering, how important do you think this Russian science has become to the forestry fieldwork that you do?
I guess one of the reasons that I got curious about it originally is I really recognize that if they're right, and I should, you know, to lay the colors out, I'm convinced they are right. I'll be convinced until somebody gives me good evidence that they're wrong. And, you know, I've been working on this now for about 10 years, and I keep asking people, because many people disagree with this theory. I mean, there's lots of people who don't, you know, maybe they don't want it to be true. It's hard to say always why people disagree. But I'm always saying to people, if you have good evidence why it's wrong, you know, that's fine, please share it. But I think it's such a new theory, it's hard for many people to really process and decide whether they agree with it or not. You know, we've been doing climate science for such a long time, and in a way, the models themselves are so convincing already. But that doesn't necessarily mean that every detail is correct. So you were asking, how important is the theory? Well, I guess it's fundamentally important, because if it's true, and as I say, I believe it is, it tells us that climate is much more vulnerable to land cover change, and particularly tree loss and forest cover change, than we've recognized previously. And that in many parts of the world, the climate system is fundamentally dependent on maintaining forest cover. And I guess to go beyond that, I was saying previously that there's a positive feedback that, you know, forests generate these low pressure areas and draw in moist winds that generate rain to maintain that, you know, high rainfall area, to maintain that low pressure. Well, because that's a positive feedback, if you degrade that feedback, if you degrade that system too much, you get to a point where it no longer works. It's like a switch. It goes from being on to off. And at that point, if you switch to off, you can actually have the feedback potentially working the other way. Now the oceans become more effective at evaporating than the nearby land cover. It's no longer forest. So it's no longer efficient at evaporating moisture. So now we get condensation happening more frequently over the ocean, and we get more frequent low pressure over the ocean. That starts dragging winds off the land. That brings all the moisture that's evaporated off the land back to the oceans. So instead of the winds carrying water from the ocean to the land, we now have winds carrying moisture from the land to the ocean, which is a desiccating rather than a wetting process. So you could actually imagine the sort of the Amazon basin being switched to something more like the continental interior of Australia. I mean, it sounds maybe overdramatic, but if you just look at the equations alone, they are strong enough to do this. So it's not quite as incredible as it sounds. The processes themselves, the physical mechanisms themselves, are potentially that strong.
Wow. Well, you know, it did come as a possible warning flag to me that some of the discussion about this new Russian theory, especially their ideas about where winds come from, have been published in the blogs of climate deniers like Anthony Watts and climate confusers like Judith Curry. You know these two Russian scientists. Do you think they question the science of climate change?
I think that's always a really tricky question, because there are so many aspects to climate change. And of course, I think there's probably no one climate scientist who agrees with every aspect of every detail of, you know, what you might call the consensus opinion, but we wouldn't necessarily call those deniers. So at what level are doubts or questions called denial? And I think a really important point for me, because I'm trying to sidestep this, because for me, it's about the science. In the end, we are putting forward theories, and if the theories are valid, they'll stand or fall on the data. And the political relevance, in a sense, I would prefer to step aside from, because if we're going to call climate science a science, it should be treated like a science. And that's about putting forward theories, putting forward alternative ideas. And if we can find data that supports them, looking at them further, if we find reasons not to look at them further because they don't, they fail to make valid predictions or whatever, then sure, you know, this is how science works. And let's forget the political blogs, because that really has nothing to do with what I'm interested in here.
I've looked into this discussion, and my general conclusion is not that these two are denying that the sea ice is melting and the glaciers are melting around the world or the climate change is happening, but that we may need to make some changes to some models because of a new way of looking at the way the physics and living things interact. So that's a different sort of argument, and I don't think it's political, as you say.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Douglas Scheel from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. We're talking about, I guess it's controversial science, but it's very interesting stuff, linking large forests to cyclones or hurricanes. I notice that meteorologists have also disputed this. They're pretty slow to pick it up. Do you think weather forecasters should learn more about the operations of forests in the atmosphere?
Certainly, I think it can be helpful. And I guess there are already a number of studies out there showing that forest loss or forest damage can have an impact, particularly downwind of forests, because we know that forests are such an effective source of moisture to the atmosphere. You know, over large parts of the planet, a lot of the rainfall that falls doesn't come from the ocean. It's actually moisture that's already evaporated off the land surface somewhere upwind, kind of thing. So in that sense, we already know that forests are an amazingly important source. Now, where I'm from in Ireland, most of our weather just blows in off the Atlantic Ocean. So forests probably are not that important. But if I lived in parts of central China, for example, most of my rainfall are coming from other parts of Asia and as far as Europe. Most of the water has already fallen on land and re-evaporated at least once before it falls on me if I'm a farmer in central China. Then, of course, if I want to talk about predicting rainfall and threats to maintaining rainfall in that part of the world, I should be pretty concerned about the forests that are upwind of me. And, of course, if my colleagues in St. Petersburg are correct that it's actually the forests that are drawing in the winds, I should not just be concerned about the forests upwind of me, but also the forests behind me that are drawing those moist winds to me. So it does open up a whole new set of issues, I think, that maybe people have not fully considered properly in the past. But there's reasonably good data already that forest loss does affect rainfall. So I don't think that in itself is controversial. The mechanisms we're talking about are definitely controversial, but the actual idea that forest loss has an impact on rainfall, that in itself is fairly well established.
You know, looking into this, I ran into this one little detail that really tweaked my interest. I want to ask you about it. It says information about how to perform the needed reactions, like, for example, productions of condensation nuclei by tree-dwelling fungi is written in the genome of forest species. Can you talk to us about condensation nuclei from tree fungi?
Right. I mean, these are all kind of cutting-edge science topics, so I guess you would get slightly different views from different people. But one of the things that's interesting, we were talking about condensation earlier, the idea that water can be a gas, but it can also become a liquid in the atmosphere forming rain droplets, or become an ice in the atmosphere forming snow or hail. So moisture has this ability to go from the gas phase to the solid or liquid phase. Now, surprisingly, it's quite hard to make moisture do that in the atmosphere. If the atmosphere is very, very clean, there's no surfaces there, there's no particles in any sense, you can actually get what they call supersaturation, that the air is carrying more moisture than it should. That means you could actually force more water as gas into that packet of atmosphere. But if you have a surface, and you could think of this like in your bathroom, you know, where does that moisture form? It forms on the surfaces, like on the windows and on the mirrors and things. Any little particle in the atmosphere can really change that dynamics and allow the water vapor to become liquid, or to allow it to freeze in some cases much more readily than it would otherwise. So it means that particles, and this would include some fungal spores and the likes, can have a huge impact on allowing water to condense or freeze in a parcel of atmosphere. So what we find, for example, if people have done this over the Amazon, they look for particles and find that most of the particles over a forest like the Amazon appear to be of biological origin. So that includes things like fungal spores. It includes things like pollen from flowers. It includes masses of different kinds of things like bacteria and viruses, and just dust that I guess comes off leaf surfaces that is somehow of a biological origin. Now, it's very complex because there's huge numbers of different things there. But when studies have been done, we find that certain of these particles are definitely very active, for example, at triggering freezing, or very active, if they're large enough, at making water condense. So we know these things can have quite a big impact on the local climate, getting water to go from the gas phase to the liquid or the ice phase. So that has a big impact on cloud formation, and it also has a very big impact potentially on the processes that determine rainfall.
And you say, quote, "We believe that cyclonic storms cannot maintain themselves over or near to extensive forests as they draw away moisture over the land." Let's take a case nearer to me, the massive forests of Washington State and British Columbia. Neither area is known for hurricanes, but I wonder, is it because of our latitude with cooler seas? Is it because of the mountain structure? Or are the great forests also a bit of a deterrent?
Yeah, it's difficult for me to look at a specific case like that without too much kind of detailed looking through your maps and things. But I guess where I'm more comfortable is if we look at where cyclones generally form around the world. Generally, they form in a band sort of just north or south of the equator, about 10 degrees up to 20 degrees north or south of the equator. That's generally where the storms start to form. Now, later on when they move, and they start gathering energy, they can kind of get momentum and go off on strange trajectories way out of that band. And that's where they cause a lot of destruction, of course, unexpectedly in various parts of the world. But if we think about where they start to form, we know that there's this sort of narrow band just north and south of the equator. So is it okay if I look at those areas?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think for me, the key point would be generally these are areas which are often very close to tropical coastlines. And I think something that's very striking, if you look at where these storms begin to form around the world, there's one striking gap, and that's in the Atlantic Ocean south of the equator. Now, what's special about that ocean? It's reasonably wide, but it's actually got these large forests just on either side, the Amazon basin on the west, and the Congo, the Central African forests on the eastern side. And in terms of meteorological conditions, it would look like an ideal place for cyclones to form, but in practice, it almost never happens. I think there's just been one exception in the last century of a major cyclonic storm forming in that ocean. So we would suggest that that's because of the forests on either side, and then there's multiple reasons why that could be true. And I guess one of them is the one we've already been talking about, that basically forests are drawing in moist air. Now, when forests draw in moist air, there's less moist air to feed a cyclone. A cyclone feeds upon moist air. It needs that to sustain itself. It's the source of energy that drives the cyclone. Or again, at least that's the theory that I would support. But there are other reasons, too, which are maybe less controversial. And the fact is, just to be able to get a wind to accelerate. In a cyclone, you have a slow system at the start that gains more and more energy over time and, you know, becomes this amazingly powerful storm. If you have a lot of friction on the land surface, of course, that's a brake. It's like putting the brake on a bicycle wheel as you go downhill. You, instead of accelerating, you start to slow down. So the forest is actually an incredibly strong friction on any winds blowing through it. If you stand in a forest a few hundred meters in, the wind you feel standing in the forest is very minor compared with what you would feel like on the coast where the wind is first hitting, because a forest is very good at actually slowing down wind. So it takes a lot of energy out of the wind. And I guess when you have a huge forest and a storm is forming nearby, you know, this huge atmospheric circulation that's trying to build up energy, rather than building up energy, is actually going to be losing energy.
Are there studies that prove deforestation can reduce or change rainfall far away?
There are good indications that that is true. There was a really nice study by a researcher in Leeds University from the UK. Dominic Spracklin published a nice study not so many years ago, I think about 5 years ago, and this was in the journal Nature. So this is one of the top scientific journals. And basically what he and his colleagues showed is if you take, there's a lot of great modern data out there showing various things, but what he managed to do was take data showing over the entire tropics, you can take a location on the Earth's surface, and he did this for all the locations over the entire tropics, and look at rainfall at that point, and look at where the air that's actually arrived at that point at the time of rainfall has actually been for the last 10 days. So this actually requires understanding wind strengths and wind speeds and wind directions across the entire Earth's surface over that time period. You see where that wind has come from. And what he did is he showed that when a wind is blowing at that point for several days through forests, and then you compare the same point when actually winds are coming through non-forests. I mean, just to summarize, the point is when it blows through forests versus non-forests, you get at least twice as much rain on average. So basically the implication being it really depends where your rain comes from. If it comes from forests, you get high rain. If it comes from non-forests, you get low rain. So that was a really nice empirical study, you know, huge amounts of data being processed and summarized in just one article. And basically across the entire tropics, the summary was very clear. When wind comes to you from forests, there's a high potential for rain. When it comes to you across non-tree-covered landscapes, there's much less rain. There's much less moisture.
In your view, Douglas Scheel, is the world experiencing loss of forests at a rate that will significantly affect the future climate?
Oh, definitely. And I think we're already there in many ways. I mean, it's very difficult, like the study I was just telling you. I mean, these things are very kind of conceptually sophisticated to try and do. And it's just hard to bring all these data sets together. So when people do manage to do that, it can be very impressive. And we're often dealing with imperfect data products and the like. So I've done this myself, looking at sort of records, you know, of rainfall in various parts of the world and trying to compare it with the land cover change. And often there are problems with the data. You know, sometimes for several months, perhaps the data has been collected wrong or whatever, you know, there's gaps, et cetera. It's quite hard to put together good data sets. But I think whenever people have managed to do that, we often see quite major changes in rainfall. I've seen estimates that are global estimates saying that we've already reduced the amount of moisture going into the atmosphere from land cover by about 5%. That's not a small amount. That's quite a large amount if you think that that's also moisture that could have been falling somewhere else as rain. So there are quite major changes already taking place. We've submitted an article ourselves recently looking at the island of Borneo, and we see quite a dramatic decline in rainfall. And the areas where the most decline occurs are the areas where the greatest amount of forest has been lost, for example. And I guess that's relatively typical. We often see this correlation, a greater loss of forest, a greater decline in rainfall.
As we wrap up, do you want to tell us a few words about the Norwegian University of Life Sciences and what you do there?
Well, we're quite a diverse university here, but we're basically looking at science, I guess, around land use. And in my case, I'm in the ecology section. So, of course, I'm in Norway. So a lot of what's being studied here is sort of relevant to the boreal and temperate parts of the world, like Norway. So studies on bears and lichens and that kind of thing. But Norway is actually an interesting country in that they've actually put a lot of funding and support into certain aspects of tropical countries. And that includes trying to protect or trying to understand how we might better manage and protect tropical forests. So I guess that's particularly why I'm here in Norway. And they've done a very good job of supporting particularly students from the tropics. So again, that was something that attracted me. So it is quite a dynamic environment here for the tropical students. Though, of course, it's quite a shock to come from somewhere like the equator to Norway.
Put on your woolies.
Yes, that's what I tell them. Don't forget to buy socks before you come.
We've been speaking with Dr. Douglas Scheel from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. He's been quoted by the Center for International Forestry Research in a release titled "Forest Loss May Lead to More Hurricanes, Scientists Warn." To find out more, use my links to this article and all the science we've discussed in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Douglas, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Next week, I'll be talking with Anastasia Makariva from the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute. She's got some refreshing ways of looking at forests, the atmosphere, and what human civilization means for the future climate. With disasters already unfolding ahead of predictions, it's definitely time to listen to new science that will explain it. Prepare to think differently. Last week, I spoke with Dr. Andy Ridgewell of UC California. He told us that erupting volcanoes caused a rapid 5 degrees C warming of the Earth and not methane clathrates, the frozen methane under the sea. So I phoned Paul Beckwith of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group to get his scientific response. Beckwith says methane remains a threat no matter what the cause of the PETM around 56 million years ago. He points out that the warming began when Earth was already so hot there was no ice at the poles. Methane clathrates may have already featured in the formation of that hotter Earth. Here's another difference. Vast areas of the far north were once heavy with vegetation, including forests growing around the polar sea. Scientists can still find the stumps of them, preserved in the permafrost. This time around, all that vegetative matter built up over the ages is beginning to come out of the deep freeze as the Arctic heats up. Small lakes and ponds are springing up across Siberia and northern Canada, and anything that thaws under them emerges not as carbon dioxide, but as the much more dangerous heating gas, methane. Beckwith listed off the many signs and scientific ventures which show and document that methane levels in the Arctic are rising due to a warming climate. So the Arctic Methane Emergency Group continues. Last week's interview with V. Ramanathan is lingering in my mind. If you haven't heard it, please go to my blog for September 28th, 2017. You can listen to that interview right from the blog page at ecoshock.org. Ramanathan reinforced my deep worry that we humans are sleepwalking over the climate cliff. Businessmen and politicians keep talking about the future as though it's sure to continue, much like today. Everything we've seen in Houston, Puerto Rico, and so many other places shows us something much different. From the Post-Carbon Institute, Richard Heinberg asks whether Puerto Rico without power or water is a reflection of a disturbed and declining future for us all, unless we see it as a lesson to begin that journey right now towards resilience, sustainable energy, and, I'd say, fair social relations. Our guest this week, Douglas Scheel, reported that people in Borneo are doing slightly better even as their environment does worse, and I think that's the general weird truth all over the world. Bill Gates reports that human health prospects have improved, and mass famine seen in the 1960s has not returned, despite adding billions more people to the planet. Within Western countries, though, we see a growing division between the people who can maintain that legendary middle-class life and the millions of wage slaves who don't have much of a life, the homeless, the sick, and the hopeless people. Islands and fortresses for wealth try to wall out the staggering debt and the crumbling systems. We are spending the inheritance of technology that harvests the primary drivers of life on Earth, the plants and animals, and now they are stressed, some of them, to extinction. It's odd, but these can be the very best of times for some people and the worst of times at the same time. You and I are still living at the crossroads, I think, in this time of turning. Our fossil-powered lives have decided some of the future for our descendants, without doubt, and for all living things. The time to choose a pattern for survival. Is it rapidly running out? This is Alex Smith. Thank you for keeping me company in these strange times, with the help from our esteemed guests, who I call from all over the world to help us.